Chapter 72. Tscupa Flow. When Churchill awoke that Tuesday morning, January 14th, in his bomb-proofed bedroom at the No. 10 Annex, he looked and sounded terrible. His cold, apparently the one he'd contracted in December, had deepened into a bronchitis he could not shake. Mary was back at Chequers, where, on Monday night, her own cold had driven her to bed exhausted and coughing. Clementine was concerned about her husband, especially in light of his plans to set out that morning for Scapa Flow, to bid goodbye to Halifax and his wife, Dorothy. She summoned Sir Charles Wilson, Churchill's doctor, who had last visited him the previous May, just after Churchill became Prime Minister. At the main door to the annex, a member of Churchill's staff greeted Wilson and told him that Clementine wanted to see him immediately, before he saw Churchill. She told the doctor that Churchill was going to Scapa Flow. "When?" Wilson asked. "Today at noon," she said. "There is a blizzard there, and Winston has a heavy cold. You must stop him." The doctor found Churchill still in bed, and advised him not to make the trip. "He became very red in the face," Wilson recalled. Churchill threw off his bedclothes. "What damn nonsense," he said. "Of course I am going." Wilson reported this to Clementine, who was not pleased. "Well," she snapped, "if you cannot stop him, the least you can do is go with him." Wilson consented, and Churchill agreed to bring him along. Not expecting this denouement from a simple house call, Wilson, of course, had not packed a bag. Churchill loaned him a heavy coat with an astrakhan collar. "He said it would keep out the wind," Wilson recalled. Wilson understood that the stated purpose of the trip was to see off the new ambassador, but he suspected another motive, that Churchill really just wanted to see the ships at Scapa Flow. At the station, the members of Churchill's party found a long line of Pullman cars, which suggested that the group would be a large one. His special train typically consisted of a coach for his use, containing a bedroom, bath and lounge, and an office, a dining car with two sections, one for Churchill and his designated guests, the other for staff, and a sleeping car with a dozen first-class compartments, each allocated for a particular guest. The staff members had less luxurious accommodations. Churchill's butler, Sawyers, was invariably aboard, as were police detectives, including Inspector Thompson. Churchill kept in constant touch with his office in London through whatever private secretary happened to be on duty at 10 Downing Street, in this case, John Colville. The train carried a scrambling telephone that would be connected to phone lines at a station or siding. All the secretary on the train had to do was tell the operator the number, Rapid Falls 4466, and the call would automatically be directed to the Prime Minister's office. The secrecy afforded the 11:30 special proved to be of little value. As the passengers arrived, many easily recognizable from press photographs and newsreels, a crowd gathered. A number of ministers, including Beaverbrook and Eden, had come as well to say goodbye. Beaverbrook's presence unwelcome, at least to Lady Halifax, who believed he had engineered her husband's appointment as ambassador. Neither she nor Halifax wanted to leave London. "We both felt Beaverbrook had suggested it, and I had no trust in him of any sort," Lady Halifax wrote later. "In the end we had to go, and I don't think that I have ever been more miserable." General Lee watched the luminaries arrive. "Lord and Lady Halifax, he so tall and she so small, came down the platform and endured their farewells, and then the PM with his round, fat face, snub nose and twinkling eyes, in a semi-nautical attire of double-breasted blue coat and peaked cap, with Mrs. Churchill, tall and smart-looking. Pug Ismay walked with them. Churchill, despite being obviously ill with a cold, was in high good humor," Lee wrote. The crowd outside cheered. When Ismay stepped onto the train, he was surprised to see that Churchill's doctor, Sir Charles Wilson, was already aboard. "He looked miserable," Ismay wrote, "and I asked him why he was there." Wilson told him about his morning encounter with the Churchills. "So here I am," Wilson said, "without even a toothbrush." At the last minute, Hopkins came rushing along the platform, his great overcoat flapping. There was no danger that the train would leave without him, however. Churchill would have held it for his American talisman, no matter how much time was lost. In the dining car that evening, General Lee found himself seated next to Lord Halifax, opposite Clementine and the Canadian Minister of Munitions. We really had a pleasant time, Lee wrote. Mrs. Churchill is a tall and handsome woman and had a fine scarlet cloak which started me off in high good humor. At one point, Halifax asked, in all seriousness, why the White House was called the White House, which prompted Clementine to joke that this was something Halifax indeed ought to know before he got to America. Now General Lee weighed in and described how the original presidential mansion had been burned by the British in the War of 1812. Lord Halifax looked shocked and puzzled, Lee wrote later, and I got the distinct idea that he did not know the War of 1812 had ever happened. Churchill dined with Lady Halifax, Ismay, and of course Hopkins. Churchill was the only member of the party to wear a dinner jacket, a contrast to Hopkins, who looked as unkempt as ever. After dinner, Churchill and the others moved into the lounge. Despite his bronchitis, Churchill stayed up until 2 a.m. He was enjoying himself and, with his vast knowledge of history, his power of expression and his huge energy, putting up a show for Hopkins, General Lee wrote. Hopkins is really the first representative of the president he has had a fair go at. I'm sure he never confided in or even cared for Joseph Kennedy. When Churchill and the others arose the next morning, they found that a derailment somewhere up ahead had forced their train to a halt, a dozen miles shy of their final stop at Thurso, where they were to proceed by ship to the waters of Scapa Flow. Outside was a frozen landscape, a deserted heath, wrote John Martin, the private secretary assigned to the trip, the ground white with snow and a blizzard howling at the windows. Britain's Meteorological Office reported snowdrifts in the area up to 15 feet deep. The wind keened among the cars, blowing snowy spindrift horizontally across the plain. For Hopkins, this was a landscape of despair, capping a week in which he had felt only cold. Churchill, however, though hoarse and obviously ill, came beaming into the breakfast car, where he consumed a large glass of brandy. Charles Peake, Halifax's personal assistant, wrote in his diary. The Prime Minister was eager to get out on the water, despite a susceptibility to seasickness. At one point, he declared, "I'll go and get my mother's ills," a reference to a popular drug favoured by queasy travellers. He began discoursing on the wonders of an experimental anti-aircraft weapon that launched multiple small rockets at a time. An early iteration was already in place at Chequers for defence against low-flying aircraft, but now the Navy was seeking to adapt the weapon to protect its ships. While at Scapa Flow, Churchill planned to test fire a prototype, and the prospect delighted him, until a senior Admiralty official travelling with the group interjected that each firing cost about £100, roughly $6,400 today. As Peake watched, the smile faded from the PM's lips, and the corners of his mouth turned down like a baby. "What? Not fire it?" Churchill asked. Clementine cut in, "Yes, darling, you may fire it, just once."
"Yes, that's right," Churchill said. "I'll fire it, just once, only once. That couldn't be bad."
Wrote Peake, nobody had the heart to say that it would be bad, and he was soon beaming again. As they all would discover the next day, it would indeed be bad. Chapter 73 Whither Thou Goest. With the train stalled outside Thurso, the weather awful, and Churchill so ill, debate arose as to whether to proceed or not. Clementine worried about her husband's bronchitis, and so did his doctor. "There was much discussion as to what we should do," wrote Secretary Martin, "for the sea was stormy, and my master had a bad cold." Churchill broke the impasse. He put on his hat and coat, exited the train, and marched to a car that had drawn up near the tracks. He planted himself firmly in the back seat and vowed that he was going to Scapa Flow no matter what. The rest of the party followed, climbing into other cars, and the procession set off over snow-scoured roads for a little harbour called Scrabster, there to board a small vessel that would then take them to larger ships waiting farther out. "The land is bleak, forbidding," General Lee recalled. "The only living things were herds of bundles resembling sheep, and I reflected that these animals had to grow Harris tweed or freeze to death." While some in the party boarded a pair of minesweepers, Churchill, Clementine, Hopkins, Ismay, and Halifax transferred to a destroyer, HMS Napier. The ship moved through a tormented seascape of opaque snow squalls intermixed with brilliant sun, the sea striking cobalt against the gleam of the snow-covered shore. For Churchill, bronchitis aside, this was pure delight, enhanced, no doubt, by the drama of entering Scapa Flow through a succession of anti-submarine nets, which had to be pulled open by guard ships and swiftly closed again, lest a U-boat sneak in behind. Early in the war, on October 14, 1939, a U-boat had torpedoed the battleship HMS Royal Oak in Scapa Flow, killing 834 of its 1,234 crew, prompting the Navy to install a series of protective causeways dubbed Churchill Barriers. As the Napier and the two minesweepers entered the central waters of Scapa, the sun again emerged, casting diamond light on the moored ships and snowy hills. Pug Ismay found it breathtaking and went off in search of Hopkins. "I wanted Harry to see the might, majesty, dominion and power of the British Empire in that setting, and to realize that if anything untoward happened to these ships, the whole future of the world might be changed, not only for Britain, but ultimately for the United States as well." Here Ismay was exaggerating a bit, because at this moment there were only a few important ships in the roadstead, the bulk of the fleet having been sent to the Mediterranean or dispatched to protect convoys and hunt German commerce raiders. Ismay found Hopkins disconsolate and shivering in a wardroom. The American seemed exhausted. Ismay gave him one of his own sweaters and a pair of boots lined with fur. This cheered Hopkins a bit, but not enough for him to accept Ismay's recommendation that they both take a brisk walk around the ship. "He was too cold to be enthusiastic about the home fleet," Ismay wrote. Ismay strode off alone, as Hopkins looked for a place to shelter himself from the cold and wind. He found a spot that seemed ideal and sat down. A chief petty officer approached him. "Excuse me, sir," the officer said, "but I don't think you should sit just there, sir. That, sir, is a depth charge." Churchill and company now boarded the ship that would take the Halifaxes and General Lee to America, a new and impressive battleship christened the King George V. Even Churchill's choice of this ship for Halifax's voyage had been calculated to help woo Roosevelt. Churchill knew that the president loved ships, and shared his own avid interest in naval affairs. Indeed, by now, Roosevelt had amassed a collection of more than 400 ship models, large and small, many of which would go on display at the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park, New York, upon its opening in June 1941. "No lover ever studied every whim of his mistress as I did those of President Roosevelt," Churchill said. "He chose the King George V, he wrote, "in order to clothe the arrival of our new ambassador, Lord Halifax, in the United States, with every circumstance of importance." After lunch aboard the ship, all said their goodbyes. Hopkins handed General Lee his letters to Roosevelt. Churchill and the stay-behinds climbed down into a small boat that would take them to their destination for the night, an old battleship named Nelson. Churchill was careful, as always, to adhere to naval protocol, which required that the senior officer, in this case, himself, leave the ship last. Swells heaved. The wind scoured the darkling sea. From the King George V's deck, Lee watched the little boat depart in a shower of spray. The time was 4:15 by Lee's watch, and the northern sunset was fast approaching. "The King George V departed, with General Lee and the Halifaxes aboard," wrote Lee. "There was no noise, no music, no guns. Up came the anchor and we stood out to sea." In the fading light, the little boat, with Churchill and Hopkins aboard, returned to the Nelson, where they and the others spent the night. The next day, Thursday, January 16th, aboard the Nelson, Churchill got his chance to fire the new anti-aircraft weapon. Something went awry. One of the projectiles got entangled in the rigging, Secretary Martin recalled. There was a loud explosion and a jam-jar-like object flew towards the bridge where we were standing. Everyone ducked, and there was a great bang, but no serious damage was done. As Hopkins later told the King, the bomb landed 5 feet from where he was standing. He was unhurt and found the incident funny. Churchill apparently did not. At length, Churchill and his party left the Nelson and travelled in the Admiral's barge back to the destroyer Napier, which would return them to their train. The weather was worse than it had been the day before, the sea rougher, and this made climbing from the barge to the destroyer's deck a precarious venture. Here, naval protocol called for a reversal in the order of boarding, with Churchill first to ascend. The two vessels rose and fell with the swells. Wind ripped the gunwales. As Churchill climbed, he talked the whole while, much at ease. Pug Ismay, on the barge below, heard one of the steps of the ladder crack ominously under Churchill's weight. But the Prime Minister kept going and was soon aboard. Wrote Ismay, "I was careful to avoid that particular rung when my turn came, but Harry Hopkins was not so lucky." Hopkins began to climb, his coat billowing in the wind. The step broke, and he began to fall. Roosevelt's confidant, England's potential saviour, was about to plummet onto the boat below, or, worse, into the tortured chasm of sea between the barge and the hull, which moved against each other like the jaws of a vice. Two seamen caught him and held him by his shoulders, dangling above the barge. Churchill shouted encouragement of sorts. "I shouldn't stay there too long, Harry. When two ships are close together in a rough sea, you are liable to get hurt." On the way back to London, Churchill's train stopped in Glasgow, where he reviewed legions of civilian volunteers, including fire brigades, police officers, and members of the Red Cross, the Air Raid Precaution Service, ARP, and the Women's Voluntary Service, all drawn up in ranks for Churchill's inspection. Whenever he reached a new group, he paused and introduced Hopkins, calling him the personal representative of the President of the United States, which heartened the members of each service but depleted Hopkins's last reserves. He hid, camouflaging himself among the crowds of spectators who had gathered to see Churchill. But there was no escape, Pug Ismay wrote. Churchill, noting Hopkins's absences, called out each time, "Harry, Harry, where are you?" forcing Harry to return to his side. It was here in Glasgow that the most important moment of Hopkins's stay in England would occur, though it was kept secret, for the time being, from the public. The group gathered at the Station Hotel in Glasgow for a small dinner party with Tom Johnston, a Member of Parliament and a prominent journalist, soon to be named Secretary of State for Scotland. Churchill's doctor, Wilson, sat beside Hopkins and was struck anew by how dishevelled the man looked. Speeches followed. At length, it was Hopkins's turn. Hopkins stood and, as Ismay recalled it, first made a tilt or two at the British Constitution in general, and the irrepressible Prime Minister in particular. Then he turned to face Churchill. "I suppose you wish to know what I am going to say to President Roosevelt on my return," he said. This was an understatement. Churchill was desperate to know how well his courtship of Hopkins was progressing and what indeed he would tell the President. "Well," Hopkins said, "I'm going to quote you one verse from that book of books, in the truth of which Mr. Johnston's mother and my own Scottish mother were brought up." Hopkins dropped his voice to a near whisper and recited a passage from the Bible's Book of Ruth. "Whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God." Then softly he added, "even to the end." This was his own addition, and with it a wave of gratitude and relief seemed to engulf the room. Churchill wept. "He knew what it meant," his doctor wrote. "Even to us the word seemed like a rope thrown to a drowning man." Wrote Ismay, "It may have been indiscreet for Hopkins to show his partisanship in this way, but it moved us all deeply." On Saturday, January 18th, as Churchill and Hopkins made their way back to London, Colville set out by car for Oxford and lunch with Gay Margesson, camouflaging his romantic interest with the minor deception that it was prime ministerial business that was bringing him to town. London was covered in snow, and more fell as he drove. He feared, or perhaps hoped, that Oxford by now would have changed her for the worst, her newly long hair being a symbol of Oxford's effect. But when they talked in her room after lunch, he saw that she was just as captivating as always. "I found her charming, and not so changed as I had feared," he wrote, "but I did not make very much headway. We always talk so fluently, but I can never succeed in being anything but the same old jock, and until I become, or appear to become, different, I shall have no chance of making a new impression on Gay." Soon it was time to depart. Snow fell. Gay said goodbye and invited Colville to come visit her again, and there in the snow, as he wrote with evident sorrow, Gay looked as beautiful as she ever has, her long hair half hidden by a handkerchief, and her cheeks flushed by the cold. He drove back to London through snow and ice, pronouncing the journey a nightmare. Upon his return, he decided enough was enough. He composed a letter to Gay confirming that I was still in love with her, and saying that the only solution from my point of view was to cut the Gordian knot and see her no more. I should leave no serious gap in her life, though I believed she was fond of me, but I could not hang around her as a rejected suitor, haunted by memories of what had been and dreams of what might have been. He knew, however, that really this was just a gambit, one deployed by doomed lovers in every age, and that he did not truly intend that the knot remain severed forever. So, perhaps weakly, he wrote in his diary after setting the letter aside, I postponed the project and decided to hang around for some time yet. History is full of lessons about the redemption of lost causes. That Saturday, Hitler's deputy, Rudolf Hess, once again travelled to the Messerschmitt Works airfield at Augsburg, accompanied by a driver, a police detective, and one of his adjutants, Karl-Heinz Pinch. Hess gave Pinch two letters and instructed him to open one of them after he had been gone for 4 hours. Pinch waited the 4 hours and threw in an additional 15 minutes just to be safe, then opened the letter. He was stunned. Hess, he read, was on his way to England to try to bring about a peace agreement. Pinch told the detective and the driver about what he had just read. They were discussing it, no doubt with great anxiety for their own lives and futures, when Hess's fighter returned to the airport. He had been unable to find the radio signal necessary for keeping the plane on course. Hess and the others drove back to Munich. Hopkins' visit to England was supposed to last 2 weeks. It expanded to over 4, most of which he spent with Churchill against a backdrop of mounting suspense with regard to the Lend-Lease Bill, whose passage by Congress was anything but certain. In that time, Hopkins managed to endear himself to nearly everyone he met, including the valets at Claridge's, who took an extra effort to make him look presentable. "Oh, yes," Hopkins told one valet, "I've got to remember I'm in London now. I've got to look dignified." From time to time, the valets would find secret documents tucked into his clothing, or discover that he had left his wallet in a pants pocket. A hotel waiter said Hopkins was very genial, considerate, if I may say so, lovable, quite different from other ambassadors we've had here. Churchill displayed Hopkins to the public whenever he could, both to hearten his British audience and to afford himself the opportunity to reassure Hopkins and America that he was not asking the United States to go to war, though privately he dearly wished Roosevelt could simply decide to do so without the bother of first winning over Congress. On Friday, January 31st, Churchill took Hopkins with him to tour neighbourhoods in Portsmouth and Southampton that had been heavily bombed, after which they drove again to Chequers to dine with Clementine Ismay, Private Secretary Eric Seal, and others. Churchill was in great form, Seal wrote to his wife that evening. He gets on like a house afire with Hopkins, who is a dear and is universally liked. Hopkins brought out a box of gramophone records containing American songs, and other music having Anglo-American significance, as Seal put it, and soon the music filled the great hall where the gramophone was located. We had these until well after midnight, the PM walking about, sometimes dancing a pas seul in time with the music, Seal wrote. In the midst of his circling and dancing, Churchill would pause now and then to comment on the growing bond between Britain and America, and his appreciation of Roosevelt. We all got a bit sentimental and Anglo-American under the influence of the good dinner and the music, Seal wrote. Something ineffable crept into the great hall. It was at the time very pleasant and satisfying, but difficult to convey in words, especially within the confines of a letter, Seal told his wife. Everyone present knew and liked each other. It is quite extraordinary how Hopkins has endeared himself to everyone here he has met. Chapter 74. Directive number 23. With planning for his invasion of Russia, Operation Barbarossa, well underway, Hitler found Britain's continued resistance galling. He would require every available soldier, tank and aircraft for the campaign, after which he would be free to focus his attentions on the British Isles. Until then, however, he needed to negotiate a peace, or otherwise neutralise Britain as a viable foe, and it was here, with an invasion of England at least temporarily out of consideration, that the Luftwaffe continued to play the most critical role. Its failure to achieve the victory promised by Hermann Göring was undoubtedly a source of frustration for Hitler, but he remained hopeful that his air force would prevail. On Thursday, February 6th, he issued a new directive, number 23, in which he ordered the Air Force and Navy to further intensify their attacks against England, ideally to cause Churchill to surrender, but, short of that, to at least weaken British forces to the point where they could not disrupt his Russian campaign. With Russia now thought to be speeding production of aircraft, tanks, and munitions, the longer he waited, the harder it would be to achieve his vision of utter annihilation. The increased intensity of attacks, the directive said, would have the secondary benefit of creating the illusion that a German invasion of England was imminent, and thereby force Churchill to continue allocating forces for home defence. Göring was dismayed. "The decision to attack the East made me despair," he later told an American interrogator. He tried to dissuade Hitler, he claimed, by quoting Hitler's own book, Mein Kampf, which warned of the dangers of a two-front war. Göring was confident that Germany could readily defeat the Russian army, but he believed the timing was wrong. He told Hitler that his air force was on the verge of bringing about England's collapse and surrender. "We've got England where we want her, and now we have to stop." Hitler replied, "Yes, I shall need your bombers for just 3 or 4 weeks. After that, you can have them all back again." Hitler promised that once the Russian campaign ended, all newly freed resources would be poured into the Luftwaffe. As one witness to the conversation reported, Hitler promised Göring that his air force would be trebled, quadrupled, quintupled. Recognizing that he could push Hitler only so far, and always covetous of his favor, Göring resigned himself to the fact that the invasion of Russia would indeed occur, and that he needed to play a key role in its execution. He convened a meeting of military planners at the Gatow Air Academy outside Berlin to begin detailed preparations for Barbarossa. "It was strictly top secret," wrote Luftwaffe Field Marshal Kesselring. "Nothing leaked out. Staffs were as much in ignorance of what was in the wind as the troops, or so the German High Command imagined." In accord with Directive No. 23, the Luftwaffe stepped up its attacks against England, hampered only by bouts of bad winter weather. Its pilots encountered little resistance. They could tell from their daily experiences that the British still had not found an effective means of intercepting aircraft at night. Chapter 75. The Coming Violence. On Saturday, February 8th, the day Hopkins was to begin his long journey back to America, the news arrived that the Lend-Lease Bill had overcome its first important hurdle, gaining passage in the U.S. House of Representatives by a vote of 260-165. Hopkins went to Chequers that day to say goodbye to Churchill and Clementine. Later he would take a train to Bournemouth to catch a flight to Lisbon. He found Churchill hard at work, preparing a speech for broadcast the next evening, Sunday, February 9th. Churchill paced. A secretary typed. Hopkins watched, enthralled. The speech was ostensibly an address to the British public, but both men understood that it was also to be a tool for bolstering American support for the Lend-Lease Bill, which now had to go before the U.S. Senate. Hopkins urged Churchill to make the argument that far from dragging America into the war, the bill presented the best way to stay out. Churchill agreed. He also planned to make use of a note from Roosevelt, in which the president, in longhand, had written 5 lines from a poem by Longfellow. Hopkins left Churchill a thank you note. "My dear Prime Minister," he wrote, "I shall never forget these days with you, your supreme confidence and will to victory. Britain I have ever liked. I like it the more. As I leave for America tonight, I wish you great and good luck. Confusion to your enemies. Victory for Britain." Late that night, Hopkins boarded a train for Bournemouth. He arrived at the nearby seaplane port at Poole the next morning, Sunday, to find that bad weather had forced the postponement of his flight to Lisbon. Brendan Bracken had come along to see him off. Hopkins was accompanied as well by a British security agent, assigned to watch over him all the way to Washington, owing to his habit of leaving confidential papers lying around his hotel room. The agent was to stay particularly close in Lisbon, by now notorious as a centre for espionage. On Sunday evening, Hopkins, Bracken and others convened in the bar of the Branksome Tower Hotel in Poole to listen to Churchill's broadcast. Later, Home Intelligence would report that elements of the speech made some people's flesh creep. Churchill opened by offering praise to the citizens of London and elsewhere who had withstood German raids, noting that the German Air Force had dropped 3 or 4 tons of bombs upon us for every ton we could send to Germany in return. He singled out the police for special acclaim, noting that they have been in it everywhere, all the time, and as a working woman wrote to me, what gentlemen they are. He applauded successes against Italy in the Middle East. He cited Hopkins's visit as a mark of America's sympathy and goodwill. In the last war, Churchill said, launching into a passage clearly inspired by Hopkins's advice, the United States sent 2 million men across the Atlantic. But this is not a war of vast armies, firing immense masses of shells at one another. We do not need the gallant armies which are forming throughout the American Union. We do not need them this year, nor next year, nor any year that I can foresee. What he did need, he said, were supplies and ships. We need them here, and we need to bring them here. With the passing of winter, he continued, the threat of invasion would arise anew, in a different, potentially more dangerous form. A Nazi invasion of Great Britain last autumn would have been a more or less improvised affair. He said, Hitler took it for granted that when France gave in, we should give in. But we did not give in, and he had to think again. Now, Churchill said, Germany will have had time to plan and to build the necessary equipment and landing craft. We must all be prepared to meet gas attacks, parachute attacks, and glider attacks with constancy, forethought, and practiced skill. For the fact remained, in order to win the war, Hitler must destroy Great Britain. But no matter how far Germany advanced, or how much more territory it seized, Hitler would not prevail. The might of the British Empire, nay, in a certain sense, the whole English-speaking world, was on his trail, bearing with them the swords of justice. By implication, one of those sword-bearers was America, and now, rearing toward his closing, Churchill quoted the handwritten note sent to him by Roosevelt. Sail on, O ship of state, Churchill rumbled. Sail on, O Union, strong and great. Humanity with all its fears, with all the hopes of future years, is hanging breathless on thy fate. Churchill asked his listeners how he should respond. What is the answer that I shall give, in your name, to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 millions? Here is the answer. Most of Britain was listening, 70% of potential listeners. At the Branksome Tower Hotel, Hopkins listened. Colville, with a rare weekend off, listened too, after dining with his mother and brother at Madderley Manor, his grandfather's country home in North Staffordshire, 140 miles from London. The night was cold and rainy, but numerous fireplaces made the house feel cosy. This was Churchill at his most deft, candid yet encouraging, grave but uplifting, seeking to bolster his own people while reassuring, albeit somewhat disingenuously, the great mass of Americans that all he wanted from the United States was material aid. Goebbels, listening too, called it insolent. Churchill entered his closing rhetorical drive. Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Churchill said, give us your faith and your blessing, and under providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job. That weekend, King George came to a new realization. In his diary, he wrote, I could not have a better Prime Minister. In the American Congress, nothing happened. By mid-February, Roosevelt's Lend-Lease bill still had not been approved by the Senate. Churchill was frustrated, as were the British people, who were growing impatient with what Home Intelligence called the apparently interminable discussions about the bill. Churchill was also more convinced than ever that the Luftwaffe was making a deliberate effort to kill him and fellow members of his government. The cabinet war rooms were being reinforced, but, as he told Sir Edward Bridges, Secretary to the War Cabinet, in a minute on Saturday, February 15th, one of at least 18 minutes Churchill composed that day, he was concerned that the headquarters building for Britain's Home Forces was uniquely vulnerable to attack. German bombs seemed to be coming closer and to be concentrating on Whitehall. "How many bombs have been thrown within 1,000 yards of the war rooms?" Churchill asked Bridges. In fact, by this point, at least 40 raids had struck Whitehall, with 146 bombs landing within a 1,000-yard radius of the cenotaph, the National War Monument, located a block and a half from 10 Downing Street at the heart of Whitehall. That same day, Churchill wrote to Pug Ismay on the subject of invasion. Despite intelligence reports suggesting that Hitler had put off his plan to invade England, Churchill still believed the threat had to be taken seriously. The public agreed. In January, a Gallup poll had found that 62% of respondents expected Germany to invade in the coming year. That Hitler would have to dispose of England at some point was clear, as was the reality that he would need to do so soon, before the country grew too strong. Britain was stepping up its production of weapons and equipment, and, if Roosevelt's Lend-Lease bill became law, would soon be receiving a great surge of supplies from America. Churchill's senior commanders believed that Hitler had no choice but to invade, and saw Germany's renewed bombing of London and other English cities as an ominous indication of a revived interest in doing so. Churchill was less convinced, but agreed to the extent that he believed it imperative that home forces and civilians be as ready as possible to repel a German assault, and to Churchill this meant that England's beaches and beach communities had to be cleared of civilians. "We must begin persuading the people to go away," he wrote to Pug Ismay, "and explain to those who wish to stay what is the safest place in their houses and that they will not be able to leave after the flag falls." Beaverbrook, in turn, hectored his factory managers with calls to step up their operations. The need for sustained and increasing efforts on the part of all concerned with aircraft production remains vital to the security of the country in face of threatening invasion when the weather mends, he wrote in a telegram to 144 companies involved in the manufacture of airframes. "I ask, therefore, for your assurance that work will in future continue at your factory throughout Sundays, so that the maximum output may be obtained." He sent a similar telegram to 60 companies that made gas decontamination equipment. "The decontamination devices are needed so urgently that I have to request you to work night and day shifts, and especially to work on Sundays." As luck would have it, the departure of Harry Hopkins coincided with the arrival of a period of warm, spring-like weather, with melting snow and crocuses peeking from the grass in Hyde Park. Wrote Joan Wyndham, out for a stroll with her lovely Rupert, he of the lopsided appendage, "Sunny day like spring, blue sky, wonderful feeling of exhilaration. That afternoon was one of the happiest we'd ever spent together. We were two minds with a single thought, or rather, lack of thought." That week, too, Randolph Churchill and his new unit, No. 8 Commando, set out for Egypt aboard a ship called the Glenroy. By now the unit had more than 500 soldiers, plus an assortment of officers and liaison men, one of whom was the writer Evelyn Waugh, also a member of Randolph's social club, White's. Randolph and Pamela hoped this hiatus would give them a chance to stabilize their finances, a task that was all the more vital now, as she believed she might be pregnant with their second child. "Well, it is held to be parted," Randolph told her before departure. "At least we'll get our debts sorted out." But the voyage was long and Randolph's weakness for gambling profound. Chapter 76. London, Washington, and Berlin. For Churchill, the first week of March was a tense one. The Lend-Lease Bill still had not passed, and there were signs that support for its passage was beginning to soften. The latest Gallup poll showed that 55% of Americans favored making the bill law, down from 58% in the poll that had preceded it. This may have contributed to Churchill's bad mood at the start of a lunch on Thursday, March 6th, held in the newly armored basement dining room at No. 10 Downing Street, in honor of another visiting American, James Conant, president of Harvard. Churchill was not yet present when Clementine, Conant, and a number of other guests made their way into the dining room. The prof arrived, tall and doleful, as did a friend of Clementine's, Winifreda Ewell. Also on hand was Charles Eade, a prominent newspaper editor and compiler of collections of Churchill's speeches. Clementine served sherry and resolved that the meal should begin without her husband. She wore her war slogan headscarf wrapped to form a turban. The first course had not yet been served when Churchill at last arrived. Upon entering, he kissed Winifreda's hand, a cordial enough beginning, but a disgruntled quiet followed. Churchill was still suffering from bronchitis and was clearly in a grumpy mood. He looked tired and seemed unwilling to converse. Hoping to lighten the atmosphere, Conant decided to make clear from the start that he was an ardent supporter of the Lend-Lease Bill. He also told Churchill that he had testified in the Senate that the United States should intervene directly in the war, at which point, Conant noted in his diary, Churchill became more talkative. First, and with evident joy, the Prime Minister described a successful British raid on the Lofoten Islands of Norway, carried out 2 days earlier by a group of British commandos and Norwegian soldiers. Dubbed Operation Claymore, it succeeded in destroying factories that made cod liver oil, crucial to helping Germany supply much-needed vitamins A and D to its populace, and glycerin, a component of explosives. The commandos captured more than 200 German soldiers and a few Norwegian collaborators, dubbed Quislings, after Vidkun Quisling, a Norwegian politician who had sought to ally Norway with Germany. This was the public story. Churchill, however, knew a secret, one he did not reveal to his luncheon guests. In the course of the raid, the commandos had succeeded in capturing a key component of a German Enigma cipher machine and a document containing the cipher keys the German Navy would use in the coming months. Now the code breakers at Bletchley Park would be able to read not just Luftwaffe communications, but also those of the German Navy, including orders transmitted to U-boats. Next, Churchill raised the matter most on his mind. Lend-Lease. "This bill has to pass," he told Conant. "What a state it would leave all of us in if it doesn't. What a state it would leave the President in. What a failure he would appear before history if this bill is not passed." John Corville, still keen to quit his job and join the war, came up with a new plan. On Monday morning, March 3rd, he had gone riding in Richmond Park, near the Royal Botanical Gardens in Kew, using a horse borrowed from a friend, Louis Grieg, personal assistant to Air Minister Sinclair. Afterward, Colville gave Grieg a lift back to London, and during the drive, without prior thought, told Grieg that he wanted to join a bomber crew. He had the vague idea that Churchill might be more inclined to let him go to the RAF than to the Navy or Army. Grieg promised to set him up for the first stage of the RAF enlistment process, a medical interview. Colville was delighted. Whether he was aware of it or not, the life expectancy of a new member of a bomber crew was about 2 weeks. In Washington, the War Department pored over a report assessing Britain's prospects, written by its own War Plans Division. "It is impossible to predict," the report said, "whether or not the British Isles will fall, or, if so, when." The coming year was crucial. British production of war materials was climbing, and American aid increasing, while German resources, taxed by 10 months of war and occupation, would only decline further from their pre-war peak. Within a year, the report said, the two sides would approach parity, provided Britain survived that long. The gravest threat is greatly intensified air, surface, and subsurface activity coincident with or followed by an attempted invasion. Whether Britain could withstand this combined assault was open to question, the report warned. During this critical period, the United States cannot afford to base its military program on the assumption that the British Isles will not succumb as a result of blockade, or that they cannot be successfully invaded. The critical period is assumed to be from the present moment until November 1, 1941. Hitler wanted still more force applied against Britain. America seemed increasingly likely to enter the war, but would do so only, he reasoned, if Britain continued to exist. On March 5th, he issued another directive, number 24, this signed by Field Marshal Wilhelm Keitel, chief of the High Command of the Armed Forces, OKW, aimed mainly at how Germany and Japan might coordinate strategy under the Tripartite Pact, which both had signed with Italy the preceding fall. The goal, the directive said, must be to induce Japan to take action in the Far East as soon as possible. This will tie down strong English forces and will divert the main effort of the United States of America to the Pacific. Beyond this, Germany had no particular interest in the Far East. The common aim of strategy, the directive stated, must be represented as a swift conquest of England in order to keep America out of the war. Chapter 77. Saturday Night. That weekend was to be a big one for Mary Churchill. Another chance to escape the prison room, this time to drive into London with her mother for the event that even now, in wartime, kicked off London's social season. Queen Charlotte's annual birthday dinner dance, the city's yearly debutante ball, set for the night of Saturday, March 8th. Afterward, Mary and her friends planned to continue the fun well into the next morning, dancing and drinking at one of the city's popular nightclubs, the Café de Paris. The weather promised to be lovely, clear, under a moon that was three-quarters full, a waxing gibbous. Excellent weather for young women in their finest silk, men in their evening suits and silk top hats, and for German bombers. Gun and searchlight crews braced for what was almost certain to be a very long night. At the Café de Paris on Coventry Street in Piccadilly, owner Martin Poulsen looked forward to a busy night. Saturdays always drew the biggest crowds to the club, but this particular Saturday promised to bring a larger and noisier throng than most, owing to the debutante ball taking place nearby at the Grosvenor House Hotel. The Debs and their dates and their friends, the most attractive men were called Debs Delights, would doubtless come to the club afterward and pack the place full. It was one of the most popular clubs in the city, alongside the Embassy Club and the 400, and was known to have some of the best jazz bands and most charismatic band leaders. Owner Poulsen had hired a particularly popular frontman to close out the night, Kenrick Snake Hips Johnson, a lithe, black, 26-year-old dancer and conductor from British Guiana. Slim, grey, beautiful Snake Hips, as one woman described him. No one actually called him Kenrick. It was always Ken, or just Snake Hips. Poulsen himself was known for his optimism and his always cheerful personality, which struck some as an anomaly, given the fact that he was Danish, the least melancholy Dane in history, as the club's biographer put it. Poulsen had been the head waiter at another popular club before founding the Café de Paris in what had been a downtrodden, largely empty restaurant in the basement below a theatre, the Rialto Cinema. Its new interior was meant to evoke the glamour and luxury of the Titanic. With the advent of war, the club's subsurface location gave Poulsen a marketing edge over his competitors. He advertised it as the safest and gayest restaurant in town, even in the air raids, 20 feet below ground. In reality, however, it was no safer than any other building in the neighbourhood. The club was indeed underground, but it had an ordinary ceiling and, above that, only the glass roof of the Rialto. But again, Poulsen was an optimist. Just a week earlier, he'd told the golfing companion that he was so convinced the war would end soon that he'd ordered 25,000 bottles of champagne, the drink of choice among his guests. Magnums were the preferred size. "I don't know why people are making such a fuss over the Blitz," he told a female friend. "I'm absolutely certain it will be over in a month or two. In fact, I am so sure of this that I am going to order neon lights to put outside the Café de Paris." The club was already busy at 8:15 that Saturday night when air raid sirens began to sound. No one paid attention. The first band played. Snake Hips was due to arrive soon to take the stage for his first number at 9:30 p.m. Joseph Goebbels spent Saturday night in Berlin before heading to his country home on the Bogensee the next day. His wife, Magda, was struggling with a prolonged case of bronchitis. In his diary on Saturday, Goebbels acknowledged that the British raid on Norway's Lofoten Islands was more serious than at first thought. In addition to destroying factories, fish oil and glycerin, the attackers had sunk 15,000 tons of German shipping. Espionage by the Norwegians was involved, he wrote, and noted that Josef Terboven, Reich Commissar for Norway, a German and a staunch party loyalist, had been dispatched to punish the islanders for aiding the attackers. On Saturday, Terboven telephoned Goebbels to report on what he had accomplished thus far, as Goebbels summarized in his diary. He has established a punitive court of the harshest kind on the Lofoten Island, which aided the English and betrayed Germans and Quisling's people to them. He has ordered saboteurs' farms to be put to the torch, hostages to be taken, etc. Goebbels approved. In his diary, he wrote, "This Terboven fellow is all right." There had been progress elsewhere. There have also been a mass of death sentences in Amsterdam. Goebbels wrote, "I argue in favor of the rope for Jews. Those fellows must learn their lesson." He closed the night's entry. "It gets so late, and I am so tired." In Washington, the prospects of the Lend-Lease bill improved. One important factor was a decision by Wendell Willkie, Roosevelt's past opponent, to throw his full support behind the bill. Willkie dismissed his own former fear crusade as a bit of campaign oratory. It now seemed that the bill would indeed be passed by the Senate, and soon, and without being crippled by amendments designed to undermine its effectiveness. Passage could come any day. So likely did this now seem that Roosevelt prepared to dispatch another emissary to London. This man, the antithesis of the frail Harry Hopkins, and soon to influence the lives of both Mary Churchill and her sister-in-law, Pamela. Chapter 78. The Tall Man with the Smile. Roosevelt and a guest settled in for lunch at the president's desk in the Oval Office of the White House. Roosevelt was recovering from a cold and seemed woozy. "An extraordinary meal," his guest wrote later. By extraordinary, he meant extraordinarily awful. "Spinach soup," he began. The guest was William Averill Harriman, known variously as Averill or Ave or Bill, depending on who was speaking. Wealthy beyond measure, he was the scion of the Union Pacific Rail Empire, built by his father. He joined its board of directors while a senior at Yale, and now, at the age of 49, was its chairman. In the mid-1930s, to encourage rail travel to the West, he directed the construction of a vast ski resort in Idaho called Sun Valley. He was handsome by any standard, but the two things that made him especially so were his smile, which was large and white, and the easy athletic grace with which he moved. He was an expert skier and polo player. Harriman was to leave for London several days later, on Monday, March 10th, there to coordinate the delivery of American aid once the Lend-Lease bill finally passed. Like Hopkins before him, Harriman was to serve as Roosevelt's looking glass into how Britain was faring, but he also had the more formal responsibility of making sure that Churchill got the aid he most needed and, once he got it, made the best use of it. In announcing the appointment, Roosevelt gave him the title Defense Expediter. Harriman dipped his spoon into a watery green liquid. "Didn't taste bad, but looked like hot water poured over chopped-up spinach," he wrote in a note for his own files. "White toast and hot rolls. Main dish, cheese souffle with spinach. Dessert, 3 large fat pancakes, plenty of butter and maple syrup. Tea for the president and coffee for myself." Harriman took particular note of this lunch because of Roosevelt's cold. He wrote, "It struck me as the most unhealthy diet under the circumstances, particularly as we discussed the British food situation and their increasing needs for vitamins, proteins, and calcium." Roosevelt wanted Harriman to make England's food supply a priority and spent a long while, too long from Harriman's perspective, talking about the specific foods the British would need to survive. Harriman found this ironic. As the president was obviously tired and mentally stale, in the British interest, it struck me that fortification of the president's diet should be first priority. Harriman came away from the meeting concerned that Roosevelt did not yet truly grasp the gravity of Britain's position and what it meant for the rest of the world. Harriman himself was publicly on record as favoring American intervention in the war. All in all, I left feeling that the president had not faced what I considered to be the realities of the situation, namely that there was a good chance Germany, without our help, could so cripple British shipping as to affect her ability to hold out. Later that day, at about 5:30 p.m., Harriman met with Secretary of State Cordell Hull, who was also suffering from a cold and looked tired. The two discussed the broader naval situation, in particular the threat to Singapore posed by the rising power and aggression of Japan. The U.S. Navy had no plans to interfere, Hull told them, but he personally believed that the Navy should deploy some of its most powerful ships to the waters of the Dutch East Indies in a display of force, in the hopes, as Harriman paraphrased his remarks, that by bluff the Japs could be kept within bounds. By sitting back, Hull said, America risked the ignominious result of having Japan seize key strategic points in the Far East, while America kept its ships safely moored at their big Pacific base. Obviously tired and befogged by his cold, Hull could not for the moment remember its exact location. "What is the name of that harbor?" Hull asked. "Pearl Harbor," Harriman said. "Yes," Hull said. At first, Harriman had only a vague sense of exactly what his mission was supposed to accomplish. "No one has given me any instructions or directions as to what my activity should be," he wrote in another memo for his files. In exploratory conversations with U.S. naval and army officials, Harriman found a deep reluctance to send weapons and materiel to the British without a clearer understanding as to what they planned to do with them. Harriman faulted Hopkins for this. Hopkins had seemed to have only an impressionistic sense of what the British needed and how those needs fit into Churchill's war strategy. The military leaders Harriman spoke to expressed skepticism and seemed unsure of Churchill's competence. Such remarks are made as, "We can't take seriously requests that come late in the evening over a bottle of port," which, without mentioning names, obviously refers to evening conversations between Hopkins and Churchill. The skepticism Harriman encountered in Washington now made his task clear, he wrote. "I must attempt to convince the Prime Minister that I, or someone, must convey to our people his war strategy, or else he cannot expect to get maximum aid." Harriman booked a seat on Pan American Airways' Atlantic Clipper, scheduled to depart at 9:15 a.m. Monday, March 10th, from the Marine Air Terminal at New York Municipal Airport, known informally as LaGuardia Field. Only later, in 1953, would the name LaGuardia Airport become official and permanent. Under the best conditions, the journey would take 3 days, with multiple stops, first in Bermuda, a 6-hour flight away, then a 15-hour leg to Horta in the Azores. From there, the Clipper would fly to Lisbon, where Harriman was to catch a KLM flight to the Portuguese city of Porto, lay over for an hour, then proceed by plane to Bristol, England, and catch a British passenger flight to London. Harriman initially reserved a room for himself at Claridge's Hotel, then cancelled and booked the Dorchester. Notoriously frugal, he rarely carried cash and never picked up a dinner check. His wife Marie called him a cheap old bastard. He telegraphed Claridge's on Saturday, March 8th. "Cancel my reservation, but reserve cheapest room, my secretary." Just 2 days earlier, the Dorchester had come up during Churchill's lunch with Harvard President Conant, who was staying at Claridge's. Clementine suggested that, for the sake of safety, Conant should move to the Dorchester, at which point Clementine and her friend Winifreda burst out in earthy, knowing laughter and, as another guest recalled, explained to Dr. Conant that although his life may be in greater danger at Claridge's, his reputation may be in greater danger at the Dorchester. Conant replied that as president of Harvard, he would rather risk his life than his reputation. Chapter 79 Snake Hips. Queen Charlotte's dance was held in the underground ballroom at the Grosvenor House Hotel, opposite the eastern border of Hyde Park. The Dorchester was several blocks south, the U.S. Embassy an equal distance to the east. Large Daimlers and Jaguars, their headlights reduced to slender crosses of light, eased their way slowly toward the hotel. Despite the likelihood of an air raid on such a clear moonlit night, the hotel was thronged with young women in white, 150 debutantes, and the many parents, young men and post-debs who had come to launch them into society with a night of dining and dancing. Mary Churchill, who had been presented the year before, spent Saturday with friends. She shopped with Judy Montague, bought pretty nightdresses and lovely dressing gown. She found the city busy and thronged with shoppers. "I do find London shops so gay and pretty now," she wrote. She and Judy and two other friends went to lunch, then attended a rehearsal for the ball's traditional cake-cutting ceremony, where the new debs practiced curtsying toward a giant white cake. This was no mere curtsy, but rather a carefully choreographed manoeuvre. Left knee behind right, head erect, hands at side, smooth descent, taught by dance teacher Dame Marguerite Olivia Rankin, better known as Madame Vacani. Mary and her friends watched in cold appraisal. "I must say," Mary wrote, "we all agreed this year's debs aren't much to write home about." After the rehearsal, Mary and another friend had tea at the Dorchester, great fun, and later a manicure, then dressed for the ball. Mary wore blue chiffon. Her mother and two other lofty society women had secured a table for themselves and their families and friends. As the dinner was about to begin, and just as Mary was going down the stairs to the ballroom, air raid sirens began to sound. Then came three loud bangs, these probably from an emplacement of heavy anti-aircraft guns across the street in Hyde Park, in a glade beyond the trees. No one seemed to notice or care, though the rising clamour outside certainly provided an extra frisson of excitement that had been absent in prior years. In the ballroom, Mary wrote, "Everything was gay and carefree and happy." Deeming the underground ballroom to be as safe as a bomb shelter, Mary and the other attendees took their seats, and the dinner got underway. The band played. Women and the Deb's delights began sweeping across the dance floor. No jazz here. That would come later, at the Café de Paris. Mary could just make out the muffled sounds of anti-aircraft bursts and exploding bombs, which she described as odd bumps and thuds above our chatter and the music. When the red alert sounded, Snake Hips Johnson was having a drink with friends at the Embassy Club, after which he planned to take a cab to the Café de Paris for the start of his turn on the dais. Once outside, however, he found that there were no cabs, the drivers having sought shelter from the raid. His friends told him to stay and not risk going to the café in the midst of what clearly was a major raid, but Snakehips insisted on honouring his commitment to the club's owner, Martin Poulsen, the cheery Dane, who had given him permission to play 10 one-night stands at the clubs outside London for some extra income. He set off at a run, joking as he left about his own very black skin. "Nobody will notice me in the dark." Snakehips reached the club by 9:45, dashing through the black blitz curtains at the top of the stairwell just inside the street entrance and down the steps. Tables surrounded a large dance floor in the shape of an oval, arrayed along a north-south axis, with a raised platform at the southern end for the band. Beyond this lay a large kitchen, which supplied ration-busting meals that included caviar, oysters, steaks, grouse, iced melon, sole, and peach melba, all to be accompanied by champagne. Two open stairways flanked the bandstand and led up to a balcony that ran along the walls of the club and held more tables, many of these favoured by regulars for their views of the dance floor below, and secured by large tips to Charles, the head waiter. There were no windows. The club was half full, but was certain to fill to capacity by midnight. One guest, Lady Betty Baldwin, was the daughter of former Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin. She and a female friend had come to the club with two Dutch officers. At first peeved at not being given her favourite table, she and her date were now making their way to the dance floor. The men, almost all in uniform, seemed extraordinarily handsome, the young women very beautiful, the whole atmosphere one of great gaiety and youthful charm, she said later. The couple was just moving past the bandstand when Snakehips arrived, still winded from his run. At this moment, 21 cooks and helpers were at work in the kitchen. 10 showgirls were preparing to dance out onto the floor. A waiter on the balcony pulled the table away from the wall in order to seat a newly arrived party of 6. Harry McElhone, the bartender, the former proprietor of Harry's New York Bar in Paris, now in exile, was in the midst of mixing drinks for a group of eight. A woman named Vera Lumley Kelly was putting coins into a payphone to call her mother and warn her to stay in the hall of her home until the raid was over. The band began to play a rousing jazz piece, Oh Johnny, Oh Johnny, Oh. A guest named Dan wrote a special request on a menu. Ken, it said, meaning snake hips. It is my sister's birthday. Do you think you can squeeze in happy birthday in a foxtrot? Thanks, Dan. Snake Hips approached the right side of the bandstand. As always, he wore a sleek tux and a red carnation. Poulsen, the owner, and Charles, the head waiter, stood together on the balcony. A woman on the dance floor did a brisk dance step, jabbed her hand into the air, and called out, "Wow, Johnny!" At the Grosvenor House Hotel, Queen Charlotte's ball continued without pause. Mary wrote, "It seemed so easy to forget. There, in the light and warmth and music, the dark, deserted streets, the barking of the guns, the hundreds of men and women ready at their posts, the bombs and death and blood. Outside, the raid worsened. The night sky filled with aircraft, and with sallow beams of light, as hot, bright daisies flared against a black velvet canvas. The bombers dropped 130,000 incendiaries and 130 tons of high explosives. 14 high-explosive bombs fell across Buckingham Palace and Green Park, immediately to the north. 23 bombs fell on or near the city's Liverpool Street train station, including one that landed between platforms 4 and 5. An unexploded bomb forced doctors at Guy's Hospital to evacuate the surgical ward. Another destroyed a police station in the city, the financial district, killing 2, wounding 12. Fire brigades reported encountering a new kind of incendiary. Upon landing, it launched flaming rockets 200 feet into the air. One bomb, weighing 110 pounds, fell through the roof of the Rialto Cinema, penetrated all the way to the basement dance floor of the Café de Paris, and exploded. It was 9:50 p.m. No one in the club heard the detonation, but everyone saw it and felt it. A bright flash. An extraordinary flash, a blue flash, then a choking cloud of dust and cordite, and coal-black darkness. A saxophone player named David Williams was torn in two. One of the Dutch officers in Betty Baldwin's party lost his fingers. 6 guests at one table died with no sign of external injury, and remained seated. The head waiter, Charles, was thrown from the balcony to the floor, where he came to rest against a pillar on the other side of the room, dead. One young woman had her stockings torn off by the blast, but otherwise was fine. Vera Lumley Kelly, about to dial her mother on the payphone, calmly hit the button marked B, which returned her change. At first, there was silence. Then came muffled voices and the sound of shifting debris as survivors attempted to move. Pulverized plaster filled the air and turned hair white. Faces were blackened with cordite. "I was blown off my feet," said one guest, but the sensation was that of being pressed down by a great hand. A band member named York D'Souza said, "I was watching the dance floor through half-shut eyes when there was a blinding flash. I found myself covered with rubble, plaster and glass on the bandstand under the piano. I was choking on cordite. It was black as night." His eyes adjusted. A light came from the kitchen. D'Souza and another band member named Wilkins began looking for survivors and came across a body lying face down. "Wilkins and I tried to lift him up, but the top of his body came away in our hands," D'Souza said. "It was Dave Williams, the saxophonist. I was violently sick as I let go of him. My eyes were blurred. I was walking in a haze." Lady Baldwin found herself sitting on the floor with one foot pinned under debris. "It felt very hot," she said. "I thought I was pouring with sweat." Blood spilled from a jagged wound in her face. A light appeared at the top of the stairs, and I could see people going up the staircase carrying victims on their backs. She and her Dutch officer found a cab and directed the driver to take her to her doctor's office. The driver said, "Kindly don't bleed on the seat." The 21 kitchen workers survived unhurt, as did the 10 dancers waiting to perform. An initial count placed the death toll at 34. Another 80 were injured, many maimed and gashed. Snake Hips was dead. his head severed from his body. At length, the dance at the Grosvenor House Hotel subsided, and the all clear sounded. The basement ballroom began to empty. Mary, with her mother's permission, set out with friends and several mothers, not Clementine, to continue the fun. They headed toward the Café de Paris. As the cars carrying Mary's party neared the club, they found their approach blocked by bomb debris, ambulances and fire engines. Air raid wardens diverted traffic onto adjacent streets. Among Mary's group, the pressing question became, if they couldn't reach the Café de Paris, where then should they try instead? They drove to another club and spent the rest of the night dancing. At some point, they learned about the bombing. Oh, it was so gay, our party. And suddenly it all seemed wrong and a mockery, Mary wrote in her diary. Until now, the guns, the crews manning them, and the distant sounds and flashes had all seemed very remote, outside the bounds of daily life. Somehow, she wrote, these last did not seem real. Of course, it is only a terrible dream or figment of the imagination. But now, it is real. The Café de Paris hit, many fatal and serious casualties. They were dancing and laughing just like us. They are gone now in a moment, from all we know to the vast, infinite unknown. One friend in her group, Tom Shaughnessy, sought to place the tragedy in context. If those people who have been killed at the café suddenly came back now and saw us all here, they would all say, go on, strike up the band. Carry on, London. And so they did, dancing, laughing and joking until 6:30 on Sunday morning. Recalling it now, Mary wrote years later, I am a little shocked that we headed off to find somewhere else to twirl whatever was left of the night away. In the night's incident report, London Civil Defence authorities called it the worst raid since early January. At 3 a.m., Harry Hopkins telephoned Chequers from Washington, D.C., and told John Colville that the U.S. Senate had passed the Lend-Lease bill. The margin was 60 to 31. Chapter 80. Bayonet Quadrille. For Churchill, the call from Harry Hopkins was welcome indeed, a draft of life. The next morning, he cabled Roosevelt, our blessings from the whole British Empire go out to you and the American nation for this very present help in time of trouble. His high spirits reached full blaze that evening, despite his bronchitis. Though plainly ill, he had worked all day at his usual heroic pace, reading papers and the latest intercepts from Bletchley Park, and firing off various minutes and directives. Chequers was packed with guests, some of whom had stayed the night, others who'd arrived that day. Most of Churchill's inner circle was present, including the Prof, Pug Ismay, and Colville. Here too were Churchill's daughter Diana and her husband, Duncan Sands, and Pamela Churchill. Pamela typically left baby Winston back home in the Hitchin Rectory with his nanny. An American observer, Colonel William Donovan, came on Sunday. Charles de Gaulle left that morning. The loftiest guest was Australian Prime Minister Robert Menzies, who stayed the weekend. Mary and Clementine returned from London, bearing accounts of the horrors and glories of Saturday night. The party was in full swing, without Churchill, when just before dinner he at last came downstairs, wearing his sky-blue siren suit. Over dinner the talk veered wildly, with what Colville described as a lot of flippant conversation about metaphysics, solipsists, and higher mathematics. Clementine skipped dinner and spent the evening in bed. According to Mary, she had a bronchial cold. Mary was concerned as well about her father's health. Papa not at all well, she wrote in her diary. Very worrying. After dinner, fueled with champagne and brandy, he fired up the Chequers gramophone and began to play military marches and songs. He brought out a big game rifle, probably his Mannlicher, and began to march to the music, one of his favourite evening pastimes. He then executed a series of rifle drills and bayonet manoeuvres, looking in his rompers like a fierce, pale blue Easter egg gone to war. General Brooke, the commander-in-chief of Home Forces, found it both startling and hilarious. The evening remains very vivid in my mind, he wrote later in an addendum to his published diary, as it was one of the first occasions on which I had seen Winston in one of his real light-hearted moods. I was convulsed, watching him give the exhibition of bayonet exercises with his rifle,
dressed up in his romper suit and standing in the ancestral hall of checkers. I remember wondering what Hitler would have thought of this demonstration of skill at arms. For Churchill, this was an early night, his sole concession to his bronchitis. His guests were grateful. To bed at the record hour of 11:30 p.m., Colville wrote in his diary. General Brooke observed, "Luckily, P.M. decided to go to bed early, and by midnight I was comfortably tucked away in an Elizabethan four-poster bed dated 1550. I could not help wondering, as I went to sleep, what wonderful stories the bed could tell of its various occupants during the last 400 years. In Berlin, Joseph Goebbels made note in his diary of the new punishing attacks on London, adding, "There will be worse to come."